Good afternoon, everybody, or good evening if you're in the UK with Alison Goodman or any place in between. If you're in Australia, it's the middle of the night tomorrow, I think, already, isn't it? I used to have this down pat. Isn't it like 6 a.m. now in Australia? I think it is.
It feels like it.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure it is. Anyway, so our guest host today is C.S. Harris, known to me as Candace, which is what I'm going to call her. And she's the author of the brilliant Sebastian Sancerre Regency Mysteries, which are totally dear to my heart. And Alison is the author of The Benevolent Society of Ill-Mannered Ladies, which is a title few people could actually get away with. Publishers like three words because they fit better on a book, which is starting a Regency series. So, Alison, why don't you introduce yourself since we have not talked to you previously?
Sure. Well, Alison Goodman, I'm Australian author. This is my 8th book. Previously, I've been mainly writing for the young adult market. I've had one crime novel for the adult market and now the Benevolent Society of Ill-Mannered Ladies. I have just recently completed my PhD in creative writing with my thesis on a historical fiction research methodology, which I had a complete ball about. I loved every minute of it. Yes, I am fueled by coffee and have a small dog who makes demands upon me.
You're not alone. I have three who are currently locked up in the back room with my husband, who's had cervical spine surgery and can't lift anything heavier than 4 pounds. Mm. So it's all on me. So Candace has many times been to the poison pen, and she has written beyond the Sebastian Sancerre. What else have you written, Candy? I'm trying to remember.
I started out actually writing historical adventure romances, which this book reminded me of a lot, the old kind of romances where the emphasis was on a lot of action. And then I started writing this one, which I'm writing number 20 now, which just boggles my mind. And I also did a contemporary thriller series about a remote viewer. I did 3 of those, and I've also written a sort of a coming of age book set in the Civil War in the South. So I hop around a bit. I have ADD.
You have. I've done a very poor job on keeping up with Candace outside of Sebastian Sancerre. But for Sebastian, there's hardly anyone who knows it better than I do, except possibly Candace and her editor. Anyway, ladies, let me start by asking you, why the Regency? What is it that appeals to you, Alison and Candace, in that order, about this particular period, which is smaller than most people think it is?
Well, I mean, I am a true Regency kind of gal, which is 1811 to 1820, when the Prince Regent was on the throne in the stead of his mentally ill father, George III. And I think of the Regency from, when I think of it, was it's like the 1960s. Of the early 1800s. There's so much going on in that short period. And there was the assassination of the Prime Minister and Lord Byron becoming a literary sensation overnight and the Napoleonic Wars and things like that. So there was so much going on, and there was a little bit of possibly a little bit more leeway for women before the kind of restrictions of the Victorian period really came clamping down. So I like to play around with those possibilities. And it's just an interesting period also, because beforehand it was the rambunctious Georgian period. It was bawdy, it was loud. And then suddenly the new civility came in. And within that civility, there was the manners and the etiquette. And it was kind of, for me, it's like the Georgian rambunctiousness hasn't gone, it's just been suppressed. So I like to also play around with that dichotomy of the civility, but also underneath it, the seething passions.
How about you, Candace?
Well, I have a PhD in history, and my area of specialty was the French Revolution. So when I thought about doing a historical mystery series, actually, at first thought about setting it in revolutionary Paris, but you know, that was such a brutal and depressing time. And you have to, when you write any novel, but especially when you're writing a series, you have to immerse yourself for so long in the emotions of the people of that time. I thought, you know, that would just be really depressing to constantly be thinking about this really drastic time in people's lives. So I thought, well, because I'd also studied the same period in Britain, and so I thought, yeah, I'll just move across the channel and set the book, it's still in the Napoleonic period, but set it in the Regency period, which, as Allison was saying, it's a very attractive period because you are transitioning from that Georgian era to the repressive mores, which came to dominate the Victorian period. And so you have this period, which is actually a period of tension between the two tendencies, the two zeitgeists. And I think that periods of tension in history do tend to create, to spark a lot of creativity. So this was an amazing time of creativity with the Romantic movement in both literature and in painting. And you had a lot of philosophical revolutions in the thought going on at the time. So it is a very vital period historically. And then it's just also a lot of fun in terms of the society at the time.
Yeah, I'm really going to prove myself shallow by pointing out one of the reasons I like it is I love the fashion. It was a complete revolution in fashion from the very formal and confining think about Marie Antoinette, you know, where honestly nobody could get dressed in fashion without a maid. Whereas in the Regency, women, I always love that phrase, they damped their muslins, you know, which leads me to think they had a lot of pneumonia and so forth as they're wafting around London and it's almost transparent, but that was the point, almost transparent, you know, muslin gowns and so forth. It's a big sporting age, so, you know, and also I should have mentioned Beau Brummel, who got away with a lot because he dressed so well until he went too far, which usually is what happens. He was an influencer, wasn't he, in a very modern
he was the ultimate.
He really was, right. Anyway, the sporting thing, you know, Gentleman Jackson and his boxing saloon and, you know, races and going to Tattersall's for horses, all that stuff is fun. But it also, aside from the war, which Bandus mentions, which goes on until 1815, is really, you know, the Industrial Revolution is really beginning to make itself felt. And that's really, I think, a lot to do with what transforms Victorian England into such a repressive age that people were trying desperately to get used to an industrial, more urban, you know, and it's hard to know what the rules are, isn't it, when stuff like that happens.
I think a lot of it came from the nouveau riche who were middle class, and they came into power with the Industrial Revolution, and they had a much stricter moral code than the aristocratic upper classes had had.
Yeah, but don't you think money is a part of it too? I was thinking back to a civil contract, which is my favorite Georgia here, but then David Liss wrote a really brilliant book, the name of which I can't quite remember, about the 1720, you know, the first financial bubble in England, where the Great South Sea Bubble.
Yeah. Right.
And at that point, up until then, the aristocracy was mostly about land, wasn't it? Wasn't it mostly agricultural and rents based and all? And by the time we get to the Regency, we're getting people, or even earlier, where it's money. So we have banking and we have, you know, all these instruments of finance that were coming into play. So, you know, I like all those distinctions about whether somebody's in trade. And that's why your women are interesting, Allison, you know, because they have to figure that out, don't they? How they can be genteel and yet actually make any money.
Yeah, well, they're the daughters of aristocrats and shouldn't be doing anything. but have been investing their money wisely because they inherited money and then invested wisely, and with that comes some independence, which allows them to have that privilege to be able to do more than what society expects of them, and also really really annoy their titled brother. who would like to control them a great deal more than he's able to. And so, you know, I think with that, women at that time were not expected to be dealing with money. It was not the kind of thing to do, a woman should be doing, which should be, you know, even thinking about money, or definitely not investing about it. So yes, it was it's out of the ordinary, but not, you know, it happened. And usually it was done through a mediator, but not with Lady Augusta and Lady Julia, who are in there making their money.
Well, but if they hadn't had money, their brother, who was actually throwing them out of their house, they might have been destitute and were back to the sort of thing that happened to Jane Austen and some of her contemporaries.
What, yes,
her? Candace, she is a wonderful woman, lead character in the Sebastian Sancir book. You know, does Honor have her own money in case anything happens to Sebastian? I can't remember that I've ever asked you that.
A hero?
Hero, yeah.
Yeah, is she, yeah, she has money from her father, and he settled quite a bit of money on her at the time of her marriage because he didn't have a son at the time. He does now, of course. So yeah, it makes a big difference, but both the financial stability that kind of inherited wealth gave, plus the social status that women of a certain of the aristocracy were able to get away with things which say upper middle class women would not, simply because they were trying so hard to blend in with the upper classes, and that required them to be more upright.
You're going to write about adventurous women or women investigating things and all. They have to have some latitude, don't they? They have to have some money and some social standing to get away with it. Allison, why don't you introduce us to your characters, Lady Augusta and her sister, Julia?
Yes, they're twin spinster sisters. Lady Augusta, or Gus, as Julia calls her, is the first person narrator of the book. And they are fraternal twins, so they're not identical. And they're 42-year-old women who decide to use their invisibility as old maids, with, I'll put that around there, to help other women out of peril. So they're using their privilege and their invisibility to move through society pull people out of terrible situations, because there was a lot of misogyny in that society, and the treatment of women and children was appalling. So yes, that's our two main characters. Gus is an apostate. She's lost her faith. Julia is very firm in her faith, and they're not opposites. They're complementary, but Gus is definitely the older twin, and also the more, I would say, forthright. But I would not cross Julia either. Anyway. So those are the heroines. Yes.
Hi, Candace, I'm sure you have some penetrating questions you've prepared, so I will shut up.
Okay. Your twins are 42 years old, and I thought that was interesting. So I thought you might like to talk about why you decided to make your main characters an age that a lot of other authors, frankly, have stayed away from.
Yeah. It's almost a trope, isn't it, that the Regency heroine is a young woman, and I've certainly enjoyed that throughout my entire Regency reading life, and that started at age 12. So it's been a very long time. where I was reading Georgette Heyer and Austen and many others. So, you know, I suppose I got to the age myself where I felt, you know, I just wasn't identifying with the young heroine. I wanted someone who was older, who had lived a bit wiser, probably a great deal more snarkier. And when I decided to write Gus and Julia, I knew that it was going to be, I suppose, a transgression of that kind of idea of the Regency novel. But I really felt that it was the time for the older voice to come along. So that's where they came along. I thought, well, you know, I did have it, and certainly when I put the book out for submission, there were some interested editors who said, well, can you bring the age down of the protagonists? Which was quite a monumental misread of the fact that it is a book about ageism. So obviously that wasn't the right publishers for us. So it was, I suppose, in a way, slightly risky to do that.
I was also interested in the fact that you used to write YA fantasy, and then you made this rather radical switch, which I've done myself in the past. You made this switch to writing for adults and writing a historical romantic adventure. So I was wondering, but first of all, how you find them different, how you find the genres in writing the genres different, and also just curiosity of what motivated you to make that switch.
Yeah. So I suppose the Benevolent Society of Ill-Mannered Ladies is not my first adult novel. I wrote a very, very adult crime novel that was my second novel, which had a science fiction bent as well. So I knew I'd sort of been in that area before. But then I wrote Eon and Neona, which was high fantasy. And then I wrote The Dark Days Club. Now that was Regency. And it was Regency dark fantasy, I call it. So I'd kind of softened my way into the whole into the whole historical area. When I started researching for the Dark Days Club, which is a trilogy, an author chooses the level of historical authenticity that they're going to try and achieve. And I decided I would go for as high as my research capabilities would go. So I spent a long time researching the Regency before I began writing, even though I'd read so much of it. I knew that, there is so much more that needed to be thought about and read about and considered, you know, all aspects of that society and all aspects of that political situation and the way that medicine was viewed and the way that religion was viewed. So I spent 8 months, you know, just full time researching it. And then I wrote the Dark Days trilogy. And I had a great time. That was but I wrote it in third person because I didn't think that I was ready to try and get into the mindset of a first person Regency woman. I wasn't ready to do that. I wanted to write this series. So when I finally started writing the ladies, as I call them, the ill-mannered ladies, I felt that I had enough of a sense of that world to be able to just write Gus's voice. And when she did something, what the way that was done in the Regency or purportedly in the Regency, because of course I'm a 21st century woman and I am imagining this, but you know, when she reaches for a light, it would be the particular kind of, you know, candle that they would have and that kind of thing. So that's how I kind of eased my way in from changing from the YA fantasy into the historical. I loved writing the Dark Days Club, but I am very glad not to have a magic system. I'm gonna say straight historical fiction. I just loved it because in the end, a magic system, and by the end of a series, a magic system can get very complicated indeed. Always turns around and bites you. you've set up all these rules and then you think, oh yes, I didn't think about that, did I? Have to go and backtrack all the way. So I was very pleased not to have a magic system in this, but thrilled to be able to write Gus's voice.
And what about writing for adult as opposed to young adult? How did you find that shift?
You know, I didn't find a huge shift. It's because when you're in the character, when you're writing the character, you're in that character. I'm not thinking about Lady Helen from the Dark Days Club. I'm just in Gus's mindset. And that's an older mindset. So there was no awkwardness. It was a new skin I have on. And that's where I was. So that was the older thought processes, the older, the experience is there. So I didn't find it that difficult. And I also played around with the structure of the novel. It's in three cases, so like a kind of a nod to Conan Doyle. And they're written as three novellas that have an overarching storyline. So that again was a very different way of approaching it, so that I wasn't writing the same kind of book I'd done before as in the YA area. This was a differently structured and quite a challenging structure too, to be able to create that complete story each for three times, but also have enough of the overarching storyline to carry across. There was enough challenge in there, enough difference to really divorce the two for me. I didn't feel there was any kind of problem with it. Yeah.
One of your stories deals with a madhouse, a private madhouse, which I enjoyed reading because actually the Sebastian book that comes out next spring, part of that is set in a madhouse. So I had just been thinking about them, and I thought maybe some people watching might be interested to hear what you discovered, because it really is a almost an unbelievable the what people were put through in those places.
Yeah. It researching that was all at once fascinating and appalling. It was to the stories that I read, and I read some of the reports that had been commissioned at the time. And so there was reports of what was going on, and these were people who were reformers going in and looking through these asylums, and the whole system of private madhouses, which could be set up by anybody anywhere, who had the wherewithal, no interest in mental health at all, just a money-making kind of situation. And the doctors who are specializing in mental illness, who were called mad doctors, who had the tools of the time, which frankly were not up to the task, and the beliefs of the time, which was that madness needed to be driven out of a person through quite violent means. I felt, the asylum in the Benevolent Society of Ill-Mannered Ladies is bad enough, but it's not, I would have quite lost the rompy feel of, and fun feeling of the ladies if I'd gone truly, truly, truly into the darkness that was there. And you would have, found the same things, I'm sure, of just how horrifying and what people were put through, and the way that they were treated.
And how vulnerable women were to it, because they were a handy place to get rid of women that were in the way when divorce wasn't possible easily. It was a great way to discard unwanted women.
And the abuse. When they're in there,
it would make you mad if you weren't mad.
Yes. Yeah.
I think. Yeah. Same thing with the witches, you know. I once let myself be locked up in the witches' jail in Lancashire Castle. They allowed tourists to do 5 minutes inside the cell. And I'm telling you, you're 2 minutes in and you are totally disoriented. It is so dark and so sensory deprived. You can't work out where you are. You can't find your body. You can't orient yourself and all. If you were in there for 24 hours, you would be mad. You really would. So, you know, again, it was a way of getting rid of unwanted or dangerous women to call them witches. And so, right.
There were some measures put in place. A woman of the Quaker faith died in one of the madhouses, as they were called, to use the parlance of the time, and that caused enough uproar because the Friends were very vocal with reform, so it wasn't so easy to put someone in just to get them out of the way, but it still happened because there was a lot of money changing hands and people sort of being, once they were in there, having no way of having a voice to get out.
Mm. What did you find, Candy?
Well, it was, like Allison said, it was truly horrifying. It's one of those things that you have to soften because your readers probably will find it absolutely unbelievable. It's funny because there was the beginnings of a realization that these methods were totally ineffective. So there were people, particularly in France, that were pushing to ameliorate this situation. I remember reading about the Marquis de Sade putting on plays in when he was locked up in an insane asylum. I thought that sounds like it was kind of atypical of the time, but it's because the institution he was in was actually run by a very open-minded man who realized that things like creativity, music could actually help these people in ways that the incredibly brutal tortures, it was just absolute torture that they were being put through, hadn't worked. And so, I mean, there must be something else that they could do. Yeah.
And the Quakers built a purpose-built hospital where the belief was that gentle exercise, having a purpose during the day, a good diet, because people were starving in these places and being fed very bad food, that good diet would all help settle one's mental situation. And that was the beginning of all the major reforms in England. Yeah.
So when this book was presented to me, publishers thoughtfully give you a cheat sheet when they send you an advanced reading copy in case you either don't have time to read it or you're not sure that you can master it. And this was presented to me, I thought this was an interesting slant, as fiercely feminist historical mystery, not a word of Regency. One of the people who read it and said something calls this a feminist adventure story. So, you know, I think Bridgerton's interesting because it has created a multiracial overlay on the British, you know, I mean, England has never been as racist as the United States. It's been about class more than it's been about race. But basically, Bridgerton is not truly believable, as it's presented. But it's really gotten people interested. And I think interested in women having much more power generally than they had. So do you think they're tapping into this by marketing this as a fiercely feminist historical mystery?
Most probably, yes. I mean, I think that Bridgerton has really brought the Regency into the forefront as a historical period. I mean, I think that, you know, it's always been, I mean, it's hard for me to think about why people wouldn't know about the Regency, because I've known about the Regency for so long and loved it for so long. It's kind of like it's a period that's so so bright for me. But a lot of people aren't aware or weren't aware of the Regency and what it was and how it fitted into history. So I think that's what, yeah, that Bridgerton has done that. And it's done it very well, you know, and as you say, brought a new kind of angle to it. We were working on that kind of marketing of the book as Bridgerton was sort of, really exploding out and that kind of stuff. So I'm sure it had some some part to play in it.
Well, the closer, I mean, you can't help but feel that people have fallen in love with the close, if nothing else, because the cast.
Casting
in Bridgerton is truly extraordinary.
Yeah, and I've enjoyed every one of them. So you know, it's been great fun.
It has been indeed, but I think it is provoking a lot more interest. But let's talk about sex then, because real Regency, like Georgette Hare or Jane Austen, sex was not ever explicit, was it? There was sexual tension in its romance, but you know, it wasn't. And then there's been a whole spate of Regency romance before all this, where basically it was about, you know, pornography and better clothes for a long time. Right. So Candace, your point of view character is really a guy, but hero, I don't know why I want to call her honor, hero, is very much, a feminist kind of character. But, you know, don't you think that the romance and the sexual tension between Sebastian and originally the woman that he was in love with and now hero, even if it's not explicit, is a major part of the reason people love that series?
Whenever I go on book tour, I'm always amazed. People come up and talk to me about the characters. They don't talk to me about the mysteries. Right. It seems to be the characters and that draws them in. And sex is a part of people's lives. So I think if you're going to, and love and romance, if you're going to spend time with characters, which a series allows you to do, you have to, or at least I have to, there's some people who don't. I feel that to create a really well-rounded story, you have to address that. I don't like to go into it too much because sex slows down a story most of the time, but it is a part of people's lives and it influences the decisions that they make.
Yeah, but it's not just Sebastian and Hero. Hero's father, who is, you know, in many ways the bad actor in the series, you know, his wife conveniently dies, the one that he hasn't been happily married to or whatever. And now he's remarried and he's going to be a father. He is a father by the time we get up all this. So there's, you know, that's going on, not just with the younger set, but with the older set, which is, I love the fact that Allison has Gus have a romance, you know, or at least maybe a romance at 42, when most women were considered to be, you know, on the shelf. I mean, you know, you read, who is it? Sophie, the Grand Sophie, isn't she like 26 and considered to be a hopeless spinster in Georgette Hare? I think so. But honestly, if you were in your mid 20s, weren't you generally thought to be, you know, a spinster for life?
Yeah, I think that the mid 20s was getting very worrying for the family. and 30, that was pretty much, you know, you've lost, because you only had a certain number of seasons that you could do before you'd met everybody and everyone had said no, whatever it is, or you'd said no and they'd said no. So there was a younger kind of age when people were considered no longer viable.
The widows, you know, were allowed to, you know, to have romances and remarry. It's unmarried women who are aging that where that really applies. But, you know, widows had actually, if you were in that period, being a widow was possibly the freest you could ever be.
Yeah, and that, a double standard that was, you know, ridiculous and based on, I think, I don't know, I mean, I hadn't sort of thought it through, but it seems to be that if you've had sex, all to the good, if you haven't, then you're just an aging spinster, you know, haven't proved yourself, you know, in terms of the one main job of a woman, which was to have children.
Right. And so men often, you know, remarried younger women if they wanted more children, on the theory that women of their own age were probably past childbearing years. How old is Hero's stepmother? I can't remember, Candace.
She's a little bit older than Hero, but not a lot.
But not much, right?
Yeah. And obviously as long as you had money, I think that, you know, whether you were spinster or a widow, you could probably get a husband. Or if you had, be from a good family, so that you had the lure of ties to power. But I suspect there was also an assumption that a lot of women who weren't married, but maybe perhaps didn't want to get married, and this was an age when people, of course, did not talk about sexual inclinations, but it certainly existed. So that assumption may have also played a part, that if someone was relatively attractive and had a dowry but was turning everyone down, maybe people thought, well, she doesn't like, you know, that doesn't interest her.
Mm, mm. It's a subject that some authors and I have long debated, whether Elizabeth I chose not to be married because, I mean, there are a lot of theories advanced. My own theory, I've often thought about it, was that she did actually have sex with, I can't remember his name, the one who married the widow, Catherine Parr, and then lost his head. And she knew she was, whatever happened, she knew she was sterile. So there wasn't any reason for her to get married if she couldn't have children. Now, that's been a topic hotly debated by various people I know, but if the first duty of a monarch is to have an heir, and she didn't do that, then you have to ask yourself, was she afraid she'd die in childbirth? She just didn't like sex. She didn't want to have a husband chop her head off. Or maybe she knew that she couldn't have children. And, you know, because I mean, miscarriages and abortions were pretty brutal back then. I've just been reading Lisa See's new book about the Ming Dynasty, Lady Tan and her circle of women. It's absolutely brilliant, but it does focus on childbirth and gynecology back then, and, you know, how at risk every woman was when she was pregnant. Mm. You know, even in Downton, if you remember, we lost somebody to preeclampsia in the first season, I think it was, or second, whatever. So, I mean, there was a serious risk of dying in childbirth at all times. So maybe some women just didn't want to go through that, since no birth control was really safe.
Mm. Yep. It's a reasonable fear at that time, you know, because the mortality rate was huge, was high. It's like, I've seen it as a 1 in 3, but maybe that's too high. But yeah.
I don't know. I mean, a lot of it would have depended on pandemics coming by, or outbreaks of scarlet fever or smallpox or something. I mean, there were a lot of factors in play for infant mortality, but mother's mortality, I think, is a slightly different question.
Mm.
Right.
Mm. Well, so, the fact that they didn't know about ectopic pregnancies, or they couldn't do anything about it. And that's a fairly high percentage of women that suffer from that. So they would, but those people right there off, right off the top, would have been lost.
Right. Mm. Yeah. And childbed fever, because nobody knew you should just wash your hands. They didn't even figure that out till the beginning of the 20th century, you know, that it would be a good idea to wash your hands between childbeds. So there we go. Right. Mm. So Candace, what is it you love the most about writing the Regency? Is there any one thing you can point out?
It's such a swashbuckling time. It's the whole package, I think, for me. It's the you don't have the serious moral cloud that characterized the Victorian period. You don't have the clothes that both men and women were buried under in the Victorian period. And I've never been attracted to the styles of the 18th century. So it sort of hits that sweet spot. Where the clothes just look modern, I think, to our eyes, and women had the freedom to move because of their clothes. Clothes can be so restricting, and it's just it's especially at the when I first started writing it in the United States was heavily involved in the Gulf War and the war in Afghanistan, I could see a lot of parallels between the United States at a time of war and and Regency England at the time of war. I recently read a quote from a Canadian author whose name unfortunately escaped me, and he said something to the effect that history teaches us what people did, but historical fiction helps us to imagine how they felt about it. And I do think that that is a big part of what draws me to historical fiction, is just that investigation of the ways in which people differed in their thoughts and their feelings, and the ways in which they were have always been the same.
Mm-hmm. Allison?
Yeah, I think that I go back to that idea that, that the period itself is so full of opportunity and possibility. I really enjoy writing the banter and using the beautiful words that have gone out of fashion now, being able to create that sense of language and how it was used. Again, you know, writing those ball scenes, gotta love a ball scene, always a challenge, but always great fun to write. And yeah, just, I think it's just being able to, I do enjoy that weaving in of the real history with the fiction, so that, you know, bringing in Beau Brummel and bringing in Fanny Burney, so that, you know, those that reality just kind of sits and is woven into the fictional world of Gus and Julia. So I really enjoy that as well, and having that sense of that time and how bright and vivid and sensory. There was like a sensory, there's such a vivid sensory world. And yeah, so that's what I love writing.
I've always loved the elegance of the language and the formality. You could insult people so much more devastatingly.
Yes.
Formal. I mean, Jane Austen did that really well. There's some really rapier passages in there, you know, where she's, you can't do that today when, you know, we all call people by their first names and there's no, you know, stratification. I was looking behind me because one thing I meant to ask you about and I'd forgotten about, I have like four or five books by a guy who wrote Regency novels from the point of view of a Bow Street runner. And, you know, we haven't really talked about the effect that we're, you know, before any formal police system. So how does that, you know, affect what you do? Are people, do you feel like your people, if we're investigating crime, are pretty much on their own?
Well, I do. I did think about this because, of course, most investigators have some kind of official support at some point. And I do have a Bow Street runner come into it because they are so much fun to write. I didn't go with one of the real Bow Street runners. I went with my own creation of a Bow Street runner. And again, how in a time when there's no police force and no centralized records, and things that when characters, a lot of characters couldn't read, so there's a whole kind of range of things that are in place in a contemporary or later, later than the Regency crime and mystery, which can't be in place in the Regency because they just weren't there. So that was a problem solving exercise that was a great deal of fun as well, because you say, how do you work around those requirements of a sleuth when they literally did not exist, there is no kind of place that you can go for that record. You have to yeah, part of the sleuthing is finding where you might find out that information. So part of that was for me that Gus and Julia are well placed in society. They have access to resources that that they know men in government, and it was only men. They know men in government. They know the ways of squiggling out information from society. So that was part of it as well. But yes, there was a kind of, oh yeah, okay, no police officers, literally, it was very wild out there. There were still thief takers. There was still citizen's arrest, where you could just say, you did this to me, I'm taking you into the magistrate's court. So it was, yeah, it was great to be able to play around with that. Excuse me.
And does you have forensics, at least some sort of basic forensics, because you have this wonderful war invalid position as part of, your cast of characters. How much fun has that been for you? And how much do you have to be careful that you don't give him too much insight?
Well, the advantage of Gibson is that he worked as a surgeon in the army, so he's seen a lot of shattered bodies, and it's something he's interested in. He buys a lot of bodies from grave robbers to do his own dissection. So I have him know what he can observe, but stuff like determining poisons, that was that just wasn't done at the time. So I have to stay away from that. And so it is walking a fine line. Sebastian also has Sir Henry Lovejoy, who is the magistrate. And one of the things that I think there's a common misconception that grew out of the fact that it was in the 1830s that magistrates lost their ability to do detection and investigation and became simply justices, deciding cases on the bench. But actually before that time, they played a very important role and they did go out into the field a lot if they wanted to. It was sort of up to them and conduct investigations and look at clues and interrogate people. So Sebastian has that available to him. Sort of, pushes off the boring bits to Lovejoy so that they can kind of go on in the background, and I don't have to. That's always the advantage of historicals, is you can kind of things like that would bog down a modern investigation. This wasn't happening. So.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any question it would be hard to write these books if your characters didn't have some access to power, whether from relations or whether from their position in society or the fact that they had money and they were also educated too, which many people weren't. So it's truly a fascinating period. Why don't we see if Ian has any questions from the audience that he might want to bring up? I'm going to turn around and see if I can find those Regency books. I think they're in the L's directly behind me. So, Ian?
Yes, for Allison, sure. Where did the title of Benevolent Society of Ill-Mannered Ladies come from?
Ian, turn your video on. It's disconcerting to see you as a square.
Thank you. That's an excellent question. I think that, the genesis of these kind of things get a bit lost for me, but whenever I'm thinking of a title, I always think about the music of the title, of the rhythm, and so when I decided that I was going to do a longer title, which as Barbara mentioned was, would I get away with such a long title, because it is a long title. I did wait, thinking, I might have to go and change this. But from the very first, that's the title of the book. And I liked it when I put it together. What I liked was the juxtaposition of benevolent society and ill-mannered lady. So there's that kind of, the ill-mannered lady is that opposition. And for me, that's very satisfying. So where it actually came from, look, these things are, you know, I tried out many kind of titles, and then the one that is the right one just goes zing. And that was it. So, but it's probably mainly built around that juxtaposition of ill-mannered lady, which made me smile. I thought, well, if I'm smiling, then probably someone else would smile too.
What is your writing process?
Is that for me?
Both of you.
Both. Candice, did you want to start off with that?
I'm a plotter. I plot my books out in great detail. I draw up an outline ahead of time where I actually decide each scene, and then I start writing and change everything. But at least when I start, I think I know where I'm going. I have that security.
Yeah. When I started writing, my first book was Singing the Dog Star Blues. It was plotted and planned right down to the very last thing. And as I've been writing, I've got a bit looser than that. I now plot the main beats of the story, and that was, and then there's a bit of kind of organic stuff in between there as I'm building character and creating sort of the emotional through line. It's the emotional through line for me that's the most important thing, to make sure that that is at the right pitch the whole way through. I write from beginning to end, so I'm chronological. I don't jump ahead, and I don't go sort of backwards or anything like that, because I'm building suspense and I need to build that for myself. And I write a small amount each day, and when I go back to the work the next day, I read over that and I edit it, and then I keep on going. So I'm constantly doing a circular kind of edit. Write, edit, write, edit, write, and that's the way that I keep the voice fresh in my head. I suppose in the process that when I start a scene, I ask myself a number of questions that need to be done in that scene. What the aim of the scene is, and what needs to be done, and all that kind of thing, and I literally tick them off. To make sure that I've done them, so that I keep track of it all. So part plotter, part pantser. I started off very, very, very plotty, and now a little bit more relaxed.
Well, you have a lot of material to cover, because this book actually goes on for 442 pages.
Yeah.
So that's about a third longer than the average book like this.
Most, yeah, it is.
About, I think, 320.
Yeah. I think it's because it's three sort of stories within themselves, in that kind of sense, I was allowed to.
Well, I was holding it up so you could kind of see it. Before we go on, I found my book, and I'm just going to mention this to you. One thing, it breaks my heart. This book in hardcover cost $4.95 when it was published by Walker in 1972. I've had it for a very long time, but this is kind of interesting. The author's name is J.G. Jeffries. I love these books, and somebody ought to bring them back into print. The Thief Taker is an attempt, that's the title, The Thief Taker, is an attempt to break away from the pattern of the modern crime novel. England of the year 1798, so it's before the Regency, was chosen as a setting because it was a robust and exciting period, elegant and sordid, colorful and drab, intensely patriotic but unruly. The French Revolution and the rise of Napoleon was a big background. And incidentally, the English language was better used then than it is today. Jeremy Sturrock, that's the lead, is based roughly on a real Bow Street runner, a man named Townsend, who had much the same background, who was appointed one of the two bodyguards to George III, and who eventually became famous and wealthy. The runners themselves were undoubtedly the origins of Scotland Yard, and they appear to have been largely unpopular and distrusted. So we have Sturrock as a man fighting alone with practically no organization behind him, no adventitious aids such as scientific investigation and instantaneous communication, and in almost continual personal danger. So doesn't that sound, I mean, Candace, I'm going to have to find these for you, or if you come up, I'll loan them to you. You can read them in your room.
I've never actually even heard of them. That's funny.
They're absolutely fabulous. My late uncle, the lawyer, who died in the 1990s, adored these books, and he collected them and he willed them to me. And I think, as I say, I can't quite reach behind me far enough. But anyway, J.G. Jeffries, and I don't know where the files of Walker went. I think they are with Bloomsbury, but maybe I'll drop a note to the publisher of Bloomsbury, George Gibson, whom I know well, and point out to him that if the Regency is having a comeback, he has excellent material. Because these, I mean, truly, these are amazing books. I've read them several times. But I think for people interested in this period, they'd be great. Sorry, Ian, I interrupted. Carry on.
And one final question for the both of you. What advice do you have for aspiring writers?
Candice, did you want to go ahead?
I think probably my standard answer to that question is to read. Read widely. Read books you enjoy. Read books that you hate and try to figure out why you hate them. And why maybe other people love them. And read. I didn't read enough, I think, how-to books when I first started long, long ago. Perhaps because they weren't that many, but those are always useful. And just learn your craft. Learn other authors, because in a lot of ways, befriend other authors, because in a lot of ways, this is a very lonely business, and especially when you're just starting out. I started writing, ironically, in Australia. I was a member of the Australian writer or the Romance Writers of Australia before I was published, and made a lot of good friends that I'm still in contact with. So that part of it's important too.
I may vanish any second because my battery is almost run out. So if I do, I'm not being rude. I'll let you follow this up.
My advice would be similar to read in that. As much as possible, I would also say read books about structure, and whether or not you decide to use those structures or you decide to do experimental fiction or like that, but to know the basic structures of a good story, and that will hold you in very good stead, because a lot of kind of editorial time is spent on structural edits, but if you have a good strong structure, then you're in a great better shape than a lot of other works. I would say find, if you can, a group of people who you can workshop with, who are at the similar level, so that you can develop your work and learn how to workshop tactfully but honestly, and make it a safe space. If you're at school, to make use of your librarian, and libraries. What else would I say? To go in there. And I mean, there's a lot of people who say, you know, go in there and write your first draft and let it be rubbish. And yes, absolutely. Write that work, get the words down. And then the real craft, the real art, is rewriting. So learn to love the rewriting process, because that is where you are placing all of that kind of understanding and learning onto the work. So have that great flush of creativity. But most likely it's not genius. You know, maybe, but probably not. You know, the real art, the real craft comes in with rewriting. So, you know, that's where I say, learn to love that, because it's a different skill, but it's a fabulous skill.
And don't give up. That's the other part too. If you believe in yourself, don't quit. Quickly, before my computer dies, this is our historical paperback fiction of the month. I wanted to say that a lot of historical fiction, which is having a big thing at the moment, is being published in a large trade paperback format. So we've actually started a little group. It's not terribly big, but still fun, of people who are interested in reading it. And so this is our May book, and we have a June book coming up, which is a cross-dressing librarian at the end of the 18th century. So it's kind of a semi-region, a sort of Clos-de-Lot de Laclos, Les Liaisons Dangereuses crossed with something else. It's really quite fun. It has a terrible cover. I keep apologizing to everybody. If you looked at the book, you'd absolutely never pick it up. But it's really a lot of fun. So anyway, the Ill-Mannered Benevolent Society of Ill-Mannered Ladies is a lot of fun. And we encourage you to read it. Thank you very much for joining us, Allison from London. You stayed awake admirably, so we'll let you go. And Candace, always a pleasure to see you. So we'll talk about fall. Ian, thanks very much. Bye.
Thank you very much.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.